We are quickly approaching the end of 2024. And if you have not purchased an investment property yet this year, and it's been one of your goals, I need you to listen very closely. I know many of you live in areas where it's so expensive and investment properties seem impossible. I'm talking about some of the big cities. So LA, New York City, maybe even Seattle, Atlanta, places in Florida, and the list goes on. If you know that where you live is too expensive, I need you to lock in right now. Investing out of state changed my life as somebody living in California. I now invest in Ohio and I'm growing my portfolio. It's something that's possible. You just need the right information and execution. So if that's you, if you want to learn how to invest out of state, go to outofstatemoney.com and there is a free training that'll outline the steps for you and help you understand exactly what it takes. So go to outofstatemoney.com or simply go to the link in the description of this episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, Episode 2. Thank you so much, first, to everyone that tuned in to our first two episodes last week. Really appreciate everyone who has shown love on Instagram and sharing with friends and hit me up, giving me feedback and showing love. I really do appreciate it. So just a quick update on my journey in real estate investing. I closed on my first property last week in the city of Dayton, Ohio. It's a single family home. I'm very, very excited about it. Looking forward to wrapping up a few things and getting a tenant in there. I also got some more inspiration to work towards getting a second property. I was going through negotiations for a director role that I was offered in my field. Needless to say, that the negotiations did not go well. We're over 5K apart on the salary that I believe my experience warrants. And so planning to turn that down this week. And I'm going to have to just give myself another raise in the form of getting another house. And so now it's time to figure out how to get it done once this home is underway and we have a tenant in place. Anyway, I'm pumped about this episode with Todd Millionaire. I know you're going to get a lot from it, so definitely please do pay attention. Also, shout out to our show sponsors, Mint Inc. Mint stands for the Minority Interdisciplinary Networking Team. Mint empowers young minority professionals with an interdisciplinary network for learning, collaboration, and the development of entrepreneurial ventures. They just did a rebrand of their website last week. And so if you want to be a member, you can become a member for free at mintinc-usa.com. If you're an entrepreneur, if you're a minority who wants to connect with others and grow your brand and continue to learn and grow, you definitely, definitely, definitely should be a part of this network. You can also follow them on IG at mint_inc. Lastly, I want to make a plug for two new resources in our link tree. The first is the Rental Property 90-Day Action Plan by Kendra Barnes, who will be a guest on an upcoming show. I purchased this guide. It's an excellent resource. It'll tell you exactly what you need to do on the path to purchasing property and will keep you organized along the way. You can get it for $10 by using the code TAKEACTION with no spaces. You can also follow Kendra at The Key Resource on Instagram. The second resource that is new on our link tree is called Hey New Landlord by Gabrielle Martin, who will also be a guest on an upcoming show. This guide is for anyone who wants to house hack, which means to live in one unit and rent the others out. Everything you need to know as a first-time landlord is in this guide. If you're interested in multifamily, everything you need to know is in this guide. She shares what she learned along the way, what she knew, and what you can do and what you can get ahead of before investing in your first multifamily property and house hack. You can follow Gabrielle at Invest and Chill on Instagram. So enjoy the episode 2, many more to come. Let me know what you think. Follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. All the comments are very much appreciated. Share with your friends, share with anyone who you think would find this to be interesting. Look forward to hearing what you guys think. Enjoy. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Here with me, I have Charles Oglesby, aka Todd Millionaire, aka Mr. I Am the Sauce. He's the co-host of the he's the co-host of the Todd Capital Millionaire Podcast and the Tweet Talk Black Wealth Podcast, which y'all should all definitely subscribe to. He's a founder and director of the Todd Capital Investment Club, And he's also the founder of Todd Acquisitions and Todd Capital Cuts. And he's also a lawyer. So his brother's up to a lot. We'll talk more about it. So definitely appreciate you coming on, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. Happy to be here.
Absolutely, absolutely. So first, tell us more about what your childhood was like and what you saw or what you didn't see that shaped your view of building wealth.
Man, that is an interesting question. I would say that it's because there's so many different things that I think shaped me, but I would just say that from the ground level, having parents always talk about this, like having parents who did whatever it took to make it is a lot of what shaped me into becoming the whatever it takes to make a type person, not even on an entrepreneurship level, but just on a personal achievement level, just on a making it in America level. And so there's so many different things that go into it, like having a set of core values, having a set of morals and standards, carrying yourself a certain way, being presentable, being well-groomed. Those are different things that my dad instilled in me because he was a part of the military. So he served in the Navy. I come from a long line of military family. I didn't realize how big of an impact that had on me until recently because my uncle was in the Army and he kind of ran his house like he was a drill sergeant. And so there was just certain things that were expected. There were no excuses. There were no good reasons. It was either produce or it was like either no excuse, just produce. And so I think that at a foundational level, those values instilled in me a lot of things that carry over into other areas of my life. And then in regards to just like my mom, so she worked as a bookkeeper, and then she continued to step her career up every year after year after year. And so now she's a CPA. So she went from bookkeeper to CPA to wow. CPA manager. She's now working for this large firm. And she did that by working her job during the day and then going to school at night while also raising her two kids. And so I feel like a lot of those things impacted me in ways that I didn't really realize. Cause now it's like you said, I do a lot, but it's because I've seen people do a lot my entire life. I've never seen people just sit back and say, oh, well, this is America and this is what happened to us. So therefore I can't make it. Like, no, they sacrificed their weekends. They sacrificed their evenings. They made sure they were at work every day on time. No sick days. Like, my family does not believe in sick days. If you get sick, that's not an excuse to sit at home and do nothing. Nah, we in the office, you're at school, you're getting it in. And that applies to so many different other things that you could use as an excuse to set you back. It's like, if you're giving up on a sick day, like, what about like the things that are a lot bigger than that? And then also, we just grew up around luxury. So I tell people, and this isn't like a knock, this is just why I am the way I am. Like, I grew up in the suburbs. I grew up around like middle class, but even still, we never really stuck around the middle class. We definitely weren't just hanging around like the hood or like the urban society, no knock against that. But we were always in La Jolla. We were always in the luxury areas of town. And so I think that is what sparked me. I'll never forget one time we were walking around this boat dealership, and I asked the person, I always do this. When I was younger, I used to do this a lot because I didn't know. But I would always ask, like, what kind of person buys a boat like this so I could become that person? Mm-hmm. I used to walk around because we're from San Diego originally. Right. I was walking around like these luxury lofts. Like, I always shop outside my reach. I always go to places where I aspire to be. And I was walking around these dope lofts in downtown San Diego. And I asked them, I was like, what kind of person buys stuff like this so I could become that person? And so then I found out, I started reading more books about those type of people. Of course, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Anything that you can read in that suite, I've pretty much read it. I'm a very, very, very avid reader. I've read countless books. I'm sitting in a bookshelf right now. So I think that is it. I was always pushed to read growing up, mm-hmm. always. So I've been reading since I could read, just like book after book after book after book. And I think that's what shaped me a lot. And of course, these days, I mean, you can listen to podcasts and you can learn what you need to learn. So all of that stuff combined kind of made me to be who I am now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And why did you decide to get into real estate?
I think that it's because of the potential to build wealth. In a lot of ways, I feel like real estate is a base level. So real estate frees you up from having to work for money. So then you can build a business. And I feel like you really make your money in business, but real estate allows you to transition from being an employee, working your 9 to 5, to now using your effort to build that business that really makes you rich. And so business is, in my opinion, is kind of like a retirement tool. So you use the passive income to replace your working income. And then it's like, okay, I can build Tide Capital. I can build Tide Consulting. I can build all these organizations, because I always tell people that like Tide Capital is the business, but then we're also in the business of real estate. So you have the business of the real estate, you have the business of the rental properties, the business of flipping the properties, business of all that stuff. But then you also have the business of Tide Capital, which people would think is in the real estate business, but really it's like in the kind of like money management business in a sense. So real estate for me is a tool. I don't personally think it's the end all be all. I think business is the end all be all, but it has a place. And I like, for me, we do mostly rental properties. So we're not buying and flipping. We're not wholesaling and offloading. We're buying for that passive income and the appreciation that comes long term. And I never sell. I'm heavily against selling. So I would just say that for the potential wealth and the freedom, that's why real estate.
Definitely, definitely. And I listened to your podcast and follow your posts and everything. And how many, was it almost 10 doors you all got last year?
Right. So we have 10 doors. We did that in about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And the crazy part about it is what having 10 doors allows you to do now. So you have equity, you have cash flow, you have reserves, and that is power. So yes, we have 10 doors. All of them aren't completely rehab yet. So we're in the process. We have like 5 that are done. Another 5, we just bought a triplex, a three-family flat that we're going to get to, that our contractor who's working on another house is going to get to after that. And so we're circling around. I always tell people, like, our goal is to develop our current inventory, not to continue to expand ourselves and buy more properties that need work. But yeah, 10 doors. Definitely. All from teamwork.
Definitely, definitely. I want to talk more about the teamwork. I know one of your big things is wealth is a team sport. So I'd like you to talk more about that principle, and then also about just like how it works with your deals. Like, is it, you know, is it a group and it's like, hey, you know, we're about to buy this house, who wants to go in on it? How do all those details kind of work?
So I hear two questions there. The first question is the aspect of a team sport. Mm-hmm. And I would just tell you that you'll be surprised what you can accomplish when you have a lot of people that contribute what they have. Mm-hmm. You don't have to work with super sophisticated, wealthy people who can write you a check for $100,000. You can work with a few people that can write you a check for $1,000 or $2,000 or $5,000. And for me, I always tell people, like, my goal, I tell people, like, you can use, I have a degree in finance, of course, a law degree, and I'm like halfway through my MBA program. You can use your powers and your education to enrich the wealthy, or you can use it to enrich your own community. I chose to enrich my own community. And so I put a bunch of us together, and then a bunch of us can then go and attack deals that one of us couldn't attack, but the deal still gets attacked. And so I tell people, like, if there's something that you want and you haven't accomplished it yet, you're probably missing a partner. And so many of us are afraid to partner, but the people that I work with still get to go out there and brag about the stuff that they own. The people that I work with get to brag about the rental income. They get to brag about when they walk through the city that we own in, they're like, yeah, we own that, we own that, we own that. And the crazy part about it is keeping it 100. That's what every other community does. Yep. It's not just like one big rich dude. No, the Asian community moves as a unit. The Jewish community moves as a unit. So like, we own that. We own that. But at least it's owned by us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the most frustrating things. You look through the inner city, and you see a bunch of individuals struggling to get it to by themselves. Meanwhile, if you look in even Hispanic communities, they live in homes because they all live in the home together. They're not in low-income housing, not in all these different things, but if they separated and they're working against each other or working separate apart from each other, they'd have to live in low-income housing because their income's not that high. Yep. But together, their income is high. So you got to sacrifice, but at least you get to live in a safer community, a healthier community, where there's homes and streets and not like tenements with doors and the bars on the doors and all that stuff. So I'll just say, like, if we worked more as a team, there's nothing we can't accomplish. And people know that. And that's why they actively work against us working together as a team by spreading misinformation, by saying things like, oh, black people don't support black business. That's insane. If you go to any black business that's existing, I guarantee you 90% of their clientele is black. But we're taught to believe that black people don't support black business. Or we're taught to believe that women ain't nothing or men ain't nothing. And if you really think about it, like, women are everything. Yeah. Men are everything. Like, together we are everything. But we're taught to believe that we're not. We're taught to believe that we're only good for maybe money or maybe sex. And in actuality, like, there's certain intangible things. And that's one of the things that the group brings to you, is like, it's not even just the money. A lot of times it's just the ideas. A lot of times it's just the fact that I have somebody who lives in that city who can then go look at our deals because our network is so wide. So I would just say that that's what we utilized, and we did it because we saw that it worked. And we started doing it through stocks, and we just started putting people together, buying stocks. We're buying like $3,000 to $5,000 in stocks every single month. And you look up, we have all this money, but also we're doing like a 50% return on our money, because you have that mastermind effect. We have these, all these ideas, all this accountability, because people are starting to say like, well, I got my money to invest. Where's your money? So it's not like an individual effort anymore. You're being pushed to do what's right. So the team approach is that people working together to fund the deal, but also making sure that you have that team in place. You need that accountant. You need that lawyer. You need that business manager. You need that assistant. Like, that's important. I've gotten to the point in that contracting, that GC. I've gotten to the point where I just want to see your stuff. I don't want to have to do everything anymore. I should have somebody who can make that phone call. So at that point, I'm only talking to the manager of Tide Acquisitions, the manager of Tide Capital Cuts, the manager of the Tide Capital Investment Club. And I got there by doing all the work myself. And now, since I've 10x so much, I've done so much, I've taken on so much, I've been able to build something that's big enough to put other people in place. So in regard to how our deals work, for a while we struggled. We were looking in overpriced markets, and we found the Midwest. And the Midwest works because you can buy a house for like 20 grand, the whole house that people will rent from you for $1,000 a month. And so I was like, let's just put together people who have $1,000, and you put up your $1,000. And before you know, we got 17 people with $1,000, and we bought this house, and the house is paid for itself. Now we've had it for about 2.5 years. The tenant was paying us about $700 a month, $720 the last month, or the last tenant. So 1 year of $700 a month, that's like $8,000. The second year of $725, that's like $16,000. In 2 years, we've gotten all our money back. And now it's like no money in the deal at all, and it cash flows.
Wow.
And so we found out that it was working, because I was listening to the Detroit Investor podcast, and she said that a lot of people will hate on your market, but if I buy a house for $20,000 and I make $10,000 a month on that house, how is that a bad market? How is that a bad deal? People, like in California, you buy a house for, California is a terrible example, but back in the day, you could buy a house in California for $200,000 and rent it out. And you probably break even, you probably make like $400 a month, maybe less. Cause I mean, the expenses, all the stuff's gonna eat up. And a lot of people, like, we cash flow so much that the expenses don't really hurt us. But I could not imagine if I was bringing in $200 a month, which is $2,000 a year, and I had to fix a $1,000 repair. We can fix a $1,000 repair with a month and a half of rent. Whereas they're over here, that killed their whole year. Yeah. And I would be damned if I owned a property made $1,000 for the year. That makes no sense.
Right.
That's not investing to me. And so for us, we went to where the numbers made sense. Right. I always tell people, like, invest where it makes sense with a C. You live where you want to live and you invest where it makes sense. And so that's what we started doing. And the crazy part about it is you can get things done through people. Mm-hmm. And that kind of speaks to the team approach as well. I get things done through people. And so we just kept buying deal after deal after deal. And then as we keep doing deals, we get better deals because we're becoming more intelligent of how we want to acquire property, what we want to do, what we don't want to do. And we learned that because we made some mistakes. We bought a house from the land bank and it's a terrible experience. I would never do it again. So I don't do it again. And now my contractor sends us all the deals we could ever need. He sends us a deal after deal after deal. Like, the reason why we have the last maybe 4 doors is because of him. And he got it to us for like a bargain price. And now we just got to put the money into the rehab.
Definitely, definitely. And can you, so I live in Inglewood. So I'm in the LA area too. And I'm actually closing on my first single family in Dayton, Ohio. And so I want you to talk more about And so, you know, I tell people, you know, this is what I'm doing. The prices are crazy here. I need cash flow, all that good stuff. Like, oh, you're crazy. Why would you invest over there? You know, you're going to have to drive over there every month, fly over there every month and all this stuff. So tell me more about your opinion of long distance investing, why it's a good thing and why people shouldn't be afraid of it.
So a wise man named Nipsey Hussle once said that technology has empowered us all. And the most important piece of long distance investing is technology. The fact that you can go on Google Maps and look at the entire community, you couldn't do that before. You had to ask somebody's opinion of the community. And sometimes that person doesn't know what you know, can't see what you see, isn't as informed in the areas that you are informed. And so they will spread information, which will keep you small. And so I will never, like, the first thing that I did when I started investing long distance is I got a mentor who was already successful in that market. And he kind of coached me through the different things. He gave me his opinion, which was an educated and a qualified opinion, which I still take with a grain of salt. Because I always bet on myself. I always believe right. in myself more than I believe anybody. Even if you are successful, even if you are Bill Gates, if Bill Gates tells me something's not possible, I'm gonna still have to prove Bill Gates wrong. Because if I don't step into what's possible for me, I can't step into the abundance for me. And so I would just say that, like, long distance real estate investing for me came out of necessity, because I couldn't invest in California, but I knew I needed to get into real estate. And so I just kept looking and looking. And with Redfin technology, you can look at any market, which allows you to then analyze that market. So again, before, you had to go through a realtor. You had to contact a realtor who has a bias and has a vested interest and is kind of conflicted. You can go right to Redfin. You can look at what the values are. You can look at the pictures on the inside. You can look at, like, you can zoom out. You can see what all the values are in that entire community. And so I just started doing a lot of research, a lot of reading. I think I might have started doing investing in real estate long distance before David Green started kind of talking about it.
Wow.
But once he did kind of come out with that, then I read his book and listened to his podcast and really became even more informed, to the point that I kind of created my own course. But I would just say that investing long distance creates a huge opportunity because of what I call cost of living arbitrage. Meaning, if you live in California and you make $50,000 to $60,000 a year, you might not be able to buy a house in California, but you can buy a house where somebody else is out there making $20,000 a year. And so what you can do is you can reach into that market and you can buy up multiple properties, or you can partner up and buy up multiple properties from other people who live in high cost of living areas, and you can take advantage of what they can't take advantage of. And so I think that it's an arbitrage. It's a small window. People are starting to kind of realize that there's opportunity in the Midwest. They're starting to realize there's opportunities in all those areas mm-hmm. that people call flyover states. But again, I don't do it naively. Nothing that I do is just without being educated and informed. So we picked Detroit because Detroit was on the come up. I've been watching Detroit for a while, but in the news, you see this huge resurgence. There's like a spotlight on Detroit, kind of, but there's also a lot of money flowing into Detroit. So of course you have Dan Gilbert. I want to say that I think Warren Buffett at one point in time was either investing in there or told somebody to invest in there. And there's a lot of money just flowing into the downtown area, which is ultimately going to spread into the outer area. So Ford's putting more money back into their Cadillacs coming back to Detroit. And so for me, I just felt like it was a bet we're willing to take. And so it's imperfect. I still struggle with it today. Doing it long distance isn't easy. It's work, it's struggle, it's hustle, it's fear, but you can put things in place to protect against that. And so for one of the things we do is we have a security alarm, and the security alarm sends email updates to me. I can arm it and disarm it from long distance. I can trigger the police from long distance. And so I can always kind of protect that property from out of state. The other thing we do is just having boots on the ground. So boots on the ground could look a lot of different ways. You can utilize a property management company. You can utilize a mentor who's going to drive past the property every now and then. A lot of times you're working with the tenant as partners. So we kind of treat the tenants as partners in certain regards, where I'm giving you a discount, so you got to do a little bit more on your end. So sometimes tenants will try to make you do things that if you live there might be really cheap to do. You could just drive by, scrub the little wall, and it'll cost you $20 and cleaner. But if you live out of state, it can cost you $400-$500 just because they're going to try to tax you and they're going to try to find different problems that aren't really there.
Right.
And so we kind of work with our tenants in that regard. I have people send me pictures all the time. I'm always getting pictures because that allows me to kind of be there. And then what I want to do is I store those pictures in a file for that particular property, so I can always kind of access those pictures because you never know you're going to need them. The other thing that we do is I call everybody on my team every single morning on purpose to touch base, to make sure they know that I'm not letting them slack, to make sure that they know that there are expectations for that day, and so they don't forget about us. And so that's something I recently implemented because I realized, like, actually I realized when I was on vacation, is if I touch you once a day, we're going to make some progress. But if I just let things lack, we're going to probably go weeks and weeks without even really thinking about it. And so for a longest time, like, you know, when you like are a worker and you like, man, that manager is annoying. Like, I wish that manager would leave me alone. Like, I want the cool manager, the chill manager. And so when I got into a management role, I thought it was my responsibility to be the manager I always wanted. And then I realized that's why they are the way they are, because they are held accountable to the higher ups. I'm held accountable to my partners. Like, right, they expect things to be moving forward. So I got to be a jerk. I got to be annoying. Sometimes I got to talk to people crazy. I got to call you over and over again until stuff gets done. And that's just comes with the territory, but we're going to get those results. So I just say that, like, investing long distance eliminates your excuse. People will say, I can't invest because it's too expensive, so I'm just going to work my job and complain about not getting a raise. I'm saying you got to do whatever it takes. If that means you got to create new systems, if that means you got to be creative, if that means you got to go where you've never been before, at least you're accomplishing your goal. The goal, we're focused on the what, not the how. We're focused on getting to real estate, not getting to real estate if it's in my own backyard. I'm like, we got to get to the goal, period. So
definitely, definitely. And I purchased your long distance investing course a couple weeks ago, and it have a couple questions regarding it. It's something I definitely recommend everyone to look into. One thing I noticed is that you self-manage. Is that right?
We do. I do. Yeah.
Tell me, so are you the one who manages all the properties that are tenanted right now?
I do it all, man.
Yeah.
I do it all. But I'm in the process, like I said, of rolling it out. So now I've tapped somebody else who's going to manage that underneath me.
Okay.
And then I just kind of manage the property manager. The reason why we did that is because I wanted to maximize our ROI first and foremost. Because when you hire a property manager, and this is maybe me being kind of pessimistic, sometimes they're definitely going to get their 10%. They're going to get their 10% of the gross rent, period. But then as repairs come up, you're going to not only pay for repairs, but you're also going to pay for them to manage and administer the repairs. So that's going to cost you more money. I kind of wanted to skip the middleman and just do it myself. And I realized that self-managing isn't really that difficult. Managing real estate isn't that difficult. And I think that's what encouraged me to continue to do it more and more. It's gotten a little bit more intensive now just because we have some repairs that need to get done. And so I'm having to schedule those and get people out. But I always tell people, like, managing long distance is as simple as going to Google and saying plumber in Detroit, electrician in Detroit, roofer in Detroit, making the call, sending them out there and getting it done. What causes me the most stress is just making sure that we're getting the best price and making sure we're not getting taken advantage of, because I want the investment to make sense. And I think that's why I did it, because for me, it's a part of asset management. So it's not even just property management as much as it's asset management. And Tide Capital, like I said, the business of Tide Capital, we get paid to manage the asset. We also have equity in the asset as well, but that's how I get paid. I get paid because I manage the asset, which I think kind of falls into property management. So it's not easy, but it's definitely not hard. And I think that people can do it. Like, you don't get as many calls as you think you're going to get. When I realized that, I was like, why would I pay somebody to do this? They never call me. Like, they never call me. And when they do call me, it's usually something really bad. I can't imagine, like, we've had some rough patches, but a lot of times you also have to train your tenants. So you had to train your tenants to know that we communicate through these different platforms. Like, I had a tenant who, when there's a big problem, she would call me over and over and over and over and over and over again until I picked up. And I told her, I was like, don't do that. You call, you leave a message, we'll have somebody call you back. And so she started doing that, and now we're cool. And so I think that a part of it is just training your people. And also, like, I couldn't see a property manager making a better return on our property than we were. And I didn't want that to happen. And so I think that a lot of times people will hire property management out of fear. And I would encourage you to do it yourself for at least 6 months, or do it yourself for at least 3 months, and then see if you can do it. It's really not that difficult. You'll find a ways to get things done. So the way we would fill properties is we use different apps. And so we use an app called Avail. I think I mentioned that on the course. And then we also use an app called Rentalinks, which advertises to all the different like Zillow, Redfin, so that you can get your listing out to people, just like if you were like a brokerage service. And then we have these, what else do we use? I think that's pretty much it on the software side. But we try to get everybody to do everything through the software portal. I was going to say something about just in collecting rent. When we collect rent, at first we thought we were going to collect it, everybody paying it through our online portal, but a lot of times people don't really have computer access. And so they just drop it in our Chase account. So we have a national bank, and there's a Chase on like almost every other block in Detroit. So they just drop it in there. So it's not, like I said, it's not easy, but it's not hard. But I'd rather keep that money, especially as we scale. It's like you have 10 doors cash, and that's $1,000 a month I'm just giving to somebody else to take phone calls that aren't really that annoying. And if we're keeping it 100, they never really call you. And as we scale, it's going to get even easier to handle these difficulties. So I don't want to give somebody that money for free.
I hear you. And are y'all focused on a certain part of Detroit, or are your properties kind of spread among several different neighborhoods?
So we're kind of scattered out there. As we buy stuff, the goal is to buy things on that block. So if we're rehabbing a house right now, and next to it is like some homes that should be bought. And so we're looking at those homes and contacting those homeowners directly. And I think that would be like, if I'm going to focus on an area, I'm going to focus on a street, but I'm not like saying this is the zip code I want, because I know that the path to progress is coming, because I don't want to be a real estate speculator. I don't want to be somebody who's betting on some swing or some trend or some momentum to save us. We buy for cash flow, period. And if we get appreciation, great. But I'm not buying for appreciation, because that's how people get stuck, especially when they start leveraging. And so for me, I'm not so in love with picking and choosing zip codes or picking and choosing this. I'm just like, do the numbers make sense? Because right. We buy, like Jay Morrison said, we buy numbers. We don't buy real estate. We buy numbers. We don't buy zip codes, even though a zip code is kind of a number. But yeah. If the numbers on the deal make sense, that's what I'm looking for. I want to make sure that it's going to cash flow, ideally $500 a month, and it's going to give us at least a 40% ROI. If we can get at least a 40% ROI, that's what I want.
Definitely. And something else that I know you're big on are the benefits of marriage. And so can you talk more about that, and you know how that's helped you personally in just prospering your business and everything that you're doing?
So I was listening to Big Sean last night as I was driving around, and he said, man, he said, since I can't really use the word, he's like too much. What do you say? He said basically like too much extra women makes you too distracted, and it keeps you from focusing on things that matter. And I found that that is so true. A lot of African-American men lose because we're just chasing all the women we can get. Like when I was in college, it wasn't just like, I want one. Like my first year in college, I had like two girlfriends. And after that, I was like, why would I have a girlfriend when there's so many girls here? So let's just not have a girlfriend so I can have all the girls as opposed to having just one. But after you get established, it makes sense to have just one, because you realize, and I think that even as I kind of went through college, like I think my third year, that's when I kind of like the end of my third year, I kind of settled down with my wife or my girlfriend then, wife now. And that's kind of what I got a lot more focus in school. Grades just went off the charts, because it's very difficult to, it's like a shotgun. I think that marriage makes you a laser, whereas when you're just out there chasing everything, you're like a shotgun hitting whatever you can touch. And I've just seen the benefits come not just through focus, but through finances, through career progression, through the way people look at you, the way people treat you, through your business success, through your motivation, through your drive, through your hustle. I think that there's so much more value in being married than just being like a single person out here, single based on how some people do it. But I mean, the Bible kind of says that he who finds a wife finds a good thing, obtains favor from the Lord. So it's like, I don't want anything to ruin my favor. Like, yeah. I want the blessings to come from being married, because there are blessings to come from being married. And sometimes we don't really see them because maybe we don't even think they are blessings. But I've just found that it helps. It helps to have that help me. It helps to have that feminine energy in the house at all times. And that's not to say that feminine energy is superior to masculine energy. It's just that both are necessary. And I think that especially as you have kids, like, both are necessary for that kid. And I mean, not only that, just in California, it's kind of tough to really do it if you don't have two people. But when you do have two people, like, if you've seen the stats, I want to say that, like, less than, like, it's a very, very low number of African-American people that are in poverty that are married. And so you start looking at all the numbers, you start looking at like single parent households and what that leads to, where single parent homes, kids from single parent homes are more likely to go to jail or be pregnant at a young age or drop out of high school. Like, all the negative things you could ever think of come from a single parent household, not from being African American, but from being from a single parent household. The problem is too often we make them the same thing, and I didn't realize it was an epidemic until I was like in college. I was looking around. I was like, how come all y'all got single moms? Like, where are the two parent households? Then you start to realize like it was kind of a strategic plan to remove the man from the household. But the problem is people didn't know. And this is what frustrates me, is people do things that they don't know they're doing that are detrimental to themselves. And Boyce Watkins, I don't know if I should say this, but Boyce Watkins, he said that there's this thing called a useful idiot, where there's somebody who doesn't know they're working against their best interest, but they really are. And so I feel like, unfortunately, in a lot of ways, women were used to perpetuate that same system, and they didn't realize it. And they didn't realize it to their own detriment. Right. And so my goal is to let women realize, like, men are 100% necessary. Women can do it, but you can be the most strongest, most independent, most don't need a man woman that you ever need, and you'll still raise flawed children. And I feel like a flawed man is better than no man. And keeping it in 100, we're all flawed. Yeah. So I feel like everybody wants to like count out the man because he's flawed while they're sitting on all their flaws. People just aren't telling that they're flawed, because we have a very keen way of not really calling women out on their stuff. And so I found, like, I don't think that even for me, marriage is really like, people didn't, my parents, even to this day, like, they kind of think that you should do it on your own. You should be independent. But I'm like, nah, like, I look at your life before marriage and look at your life after marriage, and all the blessings flow. Like, if you look at almost all successful people, there are married. And I did it. I was like, there's got to be something to this. Like, and that's not just successful African-American people, that's successful people in general. Like, marriage helps you become what you can be.
Definitely.
I wish I had a more outline and detailed answer. Usually I answer that question.
No worries. So something I want to talk more about is HBCU Capital and Todd Investments. Before that, there's a trip I took this summer that made me think about it. So I was in Atlanta for a wedding, and I was driving by Morehouse, and I just saw all of these. So it was a mix. We're going down one street, and you see boarded up housing, and you see some that are rehab. In my mind, I'll tell my boy in the car, I said, some people see trash, others see opportunity. Someone's going to make money rehabbing this house and renting it out. And so can you talk more about HBCU Capital, Todd Investments, and the work y'all are trying to do around HBCUs?
Yeah, so I have a very close connection with Atlanta. Like, most of my family's in Atlanta. Wow. I spent a lot of time in Atlanta growing up. And it's just interesting how you look at these areas where they have these universities, and like you said, the surrounding area is not in the best condition. And so I told somebody a long time ago, like, I don't really start businesses to make money as much as I start businesses to change things. Like, I find a problem, and then I solve the problem through business. And so one of the problems was just in the condition of those neighborhoods. Like, we deserve better. If you drive around the University of Georgia, you drive around UCLA, you drive around, not USC, but USC is getting there. it doesn't look like what it looks like when you drive around an HBCU. It looks amazing. Those homes look great. And so I was like, why can't we have the same thing? And the answer is that we can have the same thing if we take the team approach. And so the goal is to really take that team approach of Tide Capital with the HBCU focus of HBCU Realty, merge the two, and see what we can create. And so we, I think that we're just kind of on the tip of the iceberg, because as we started to do more research, we started to realize that there's other groups out there doing what we're doing or trying to do what we're doing. And so it's just a matter of, for us, finding the right market. We've looked in all these different areas. We looked in Atlanta. We looked in Mississippi. We've looked in Baltimore. And now it's just a matter of getting our first deal and getting the things rolling with that. And so we have weekly conference calls. We are just looking to raise funds. But I think the big play with that might look different than what the Tide Capital Investment Club looks like. Because in this instance, we're not just looking to make money on our money. We're looking to change an entire community. And you might have to step into some bigger money when you're trying to take on a project like that. And so I think that the goal should be to start looking at institutional money, to start looking at all this rapper money, all this entertainer money, all this like athlete money, and putting it to productive use in their communities to create jobs, to create housing. It makes no sense for Floyd Mayweather to be so rich and for everybody else to be broke. Like, I just, it kind of doesn't sit well with me. It looks really silly, because you wouldn't see that in any other community, but you see that in ours. Even Warren Buffett, like, Warren Buffett doesn't walk around with all these diamonds. Oh, like, he wears a suit and he builds, like, he has Coke, and Coke creates all these jobs. It's kind of like the Chris Rock joke. He said, I know you heard it, but he's like, yeah, African-American people, sometimes we get money, we buy some jewelry. He said, but when like a Caucasian dude gets money, he builds a Walmart and creates jobs for other Caucasian people and gets even richer. And I think that's the thing about it, is by solving all these problems in the HBC community, we're going to solve a problem. We're also going to get rich. We're going to make a lot of money. Like you said, the person who flips this house is going to make a lot of money. Like, there's money that comes through solving your community's problems. And we have a lot of problems. Therefore, there's money that we're just leaving on the table because we're not willing to solve the problems. We just want to point at them and tell somebody else to come save us. And we are more than capable of saving ourselves. So I would just say that the focus there is just solving problems. I am not a problem identifier. I'm a problem solver. So therefore, any problem that I see, and this is why I say my ego is important. Like, I have a big ego, but the ego just lets me think that there's no problem that's bigger than me. There's no thing out there that I cannot find a way to solve, whether it's homelessness in South LA or Los Angeles and downtown LA for African-American men, or if it's the HBCU issue. Every single black problem, I want to have a piece of solving. And I'm not just over here doing it to make money. Money just happens to come from solving the problem. I genuinely just want to solve the problems. In a lot of ways, because I'm tired of hearing people complain about them and doing nothing, but also because I love us. I want us to have everything that we can have. I want us to have everything that I've seen growing up. I want us to have safe, healthy communities with great schools that teach us stuff that's empowering and not just defeating. And I'm willing to do the work to get it done. I like, what else is there to do in life, man? Like, you can fit in the vacations. You can fit in the fun stuff, but you shouldn't live a life for the vacation and the fun stuff. Live a life for solving problems and creating solutions and then fit in that fun stuff. And there's so much time in the day. And I think that kind of speaks to the marriage. It's like, I'm not out here looking for the next booty. I'm out here looking for the next opportunity. I'm out here looking for the next problem to solve. Like, because, I mean, getting women is a problem. It's you got to put some serious thought and effort and strategy into getting all these women. But if you don't have that problem, you could put all your thought, effort, and strategy into solving problems for your people. And so that's kind of what HBCU Capital is. It's growing. It's huge. And I look forward to seeing, like, what we can create with that organization.
Definitely. There's something you mentioned there that tied into something I wanted to ask. I want to dive a bit deeper on that. So one of the things that you mentioned and that, you know, I've seen you say a lot is don't invest for money. Can you talk more about that? Cause, you know, a lot of people invest for money, and that's kind of the one goal they have, and they don't care about anything else. Can you talk about your mentality on that and why that's helped you to attract money and make money while still helping people out and solving problems in our community?
Well, Man, I think that it kind of speaks to the idea that, like, I don't start a business just for the money purpose anymore. I start a business to change things. And so I think that investing, I always tell people, like, the inception of the Thai Capital Investment Club came from all those shootings that took place. And so we like to say, oh, you know, the African-American community is the way it is because we don't have an economic base, or we lack wealth, or we're struggling financially. But I don't think that's necessarily all the story, that we struggle because we don't have power. We don't have control. We don't have ownership. And so I always tell people, like, I want to own stuff for the ego. I want to own stuff because I know there's somebody who is indebted to me. As crazy as that sounds, like, it's a more powerful position to be in an ownership class than to be in a workers class, chasing a butt class. And they trick you with that money stuff. If you are a rapper and you go to their label that they own, like Nipsey said, they're going to give you that money on the front end so they can cash that check on the back. Like, they're foregoing the money for the ownership, because they know the ownership not only is going to pay them bigger money, it's going to pay them money for longer term, and it's also going to pay their kids. And so for me, like, I want us to get away from focusing on chasing a buck and making a buck. For example, you have, like, wholesalers, and wholesalers are going out there and they're finding these deals and it is ruining the deal for money. They're like, oh, well, this is a great deal, just give me 10 grand and you can make money forever, and then also your kids can make money. I was talking to House Buying Brian. We were talking about, like, what's the best deal you've ever done? And he was talking about how, like, a lot of people will say that I flipped this house and I made 50 grand. But what about that rental property that makes you 20 grand a year forever? You made 200,000 off of that deal, or 400,000 off of that deal. And people don't ever really think about that. They only think about what they make in that moment. And so for me, I just want people to get away from the idea of doing things for money, because that's why they clock in for a job. It's like he said, the rich don't work for money. We need to get into the mentality of just doing what's right because it's right. Owning a home because it's right. Starting a business because it's right. Doing all these things, not chasing a buck, because that's how they kind of, I guess, control people, is by just throwing money at you. Like, oh, here's a raise, brother. Don't start your own business. We'll pay you 100 grand here when you can make a billion on your own. I just feel like, sometimes I said this before, like, we have the wealth building conversation at an elementary level where we're just chasing bucks, we're chasing this cash, we're trying to get money, instead of saying, like, nah, like, big picture, big game, I want to own that whole block, just because of the power that comes with controlling a block. We've said it before that when you own a lot, then you come to the table differently. You're at the community meetings talking a lot differently. They start working for you. When you own the whole block, the city works for you. You don't work for the city anymore. You start telling them what they're going to do and when they're going to do it and how they're going to do it. And that's power. You control the police force. You're not over here like, please, police, stop doing this. Nah, police. Nah, that's not going down here. Or you bring your own community team. Like, for the longest time, I wanted to have my own police force. I want our own security force, because ego bigger than problems. Dang, that's such a, my ego is bigger than my problems.
I just, next Instagram post.
Right, right. I think that we have to start doing stuff that's going to empower us and not just give us money to buy stuff. Like, that's all I'm saying, is, like, let's not chase a deal so we can get money. Let's chase a deal so that we can empower ourselves.
Definitely. Definitely. Something else I know you're big on that's kind of contrary to popular opinion is working with family. A lot of people are just like, you know, don't do business with family, don't make some money with family, all that stuff. But I know your mom works very closely with your business. So can you talk more about why you don't believe that popular thought and how it's helped your business?
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, I don't make up this stuff. I observe successful people and I see how they do it. And then I bring it to my people. And I think that's one of the benefit of kind of being in the spaces that I've been in. So, for example, I think this idea really kind of drew every one of the last companies that I've worked with and for was a family-run business, every single one of them. And they might not realize it's a family-run business, but their family has a hand in what they're doing. And the reason why that is so important is nobody's going to have your back like your family. Unfortunately, like, if you're working with other people, they have their own family to feed. So they have competing interests. They're looking to see how soon they can pull money out of your organization so they can take care of their family. Whereas I tell people, like, if my mom works for me or my wife works for me, a win for me is a win for them. So it's not like they're trying to negotiate harder on me, because if they do that, then they lose. And we got to be on the same page in business. And this, it's even true, like, when you start looking, like, my dad has played a role in the barbershop business, and just having that knowledge is invaluable, because I know he's not going to BS me. I know he's not going to tell me something that's going to cost more than it's going to cost. So there's like a trust factor. There's a loyalty factor there. There's a having your back factor there. There is an equal win, a mutual win, where a win for me is a win for them, where my success allows them to brag. So if I'm doing well, they're like, yeah, like, Charles is out here doing this, and I'm connected to Charles, so therefore I'm winning. And so I feel like it just allows you to do more safer, because when you're building a business, especially a successful business, you never know who is out there saying, like, dang, I'm going to just do this for another year, and I'm going to start my own Tide Capital. I'm going to start my own Tide Acquisitions. I'm going to start my own this. And people have done that to me. People have come in, fell into the fold, and like, yeah, this is me capital, this is me acquisitions. And so, like, I'm trusting them. In order to do what I do, you have to be 100% transparent. I got to give you so much of what I know, and I would rather give that knowledge to somebody that I live with and that I love and that is not going to go out there and steal my idea. And so I think that in a lot of ways, doing business with family is just a form of protection, especially as you grow and you become successful. And it's also just a way to protect what you build, because if somebody can go out there and do what I do, it kind of depletes the value of what I do. Become a monopoly anymore. Now I have somebody else, so they can just go over there and they're like, oh, Charles, you're only willing to pay me this much, go and take this person. And so it's like in the book 0 to 1, like, I don't want competition. I want a monopoly. I want, for when you think of investing as a group, investing as a club, you're going to come to Tide Capital, not go to somebody else who's going to charge you 5% less, because then what happens? I got to lower my prices 5%. And it's like in the book, It's Education of the Negro. He says that if you see somebody who's successful at making money in business and you go to the same thing, neither you're going to make any money. And so that's why I always tell people, like, just choose yourself, do your own thing, run your own race. Don't copy what anybody else is doing. But working with family allows you to do that. And I think there are drawbacks to working with family, of course, but we got to focus on, like, the big win that comes with it. There's pros and cons to everything. And I never forget, like, we're going to start a catering company with my family once. And one of my cousins was like, nah, I can't work with this person because blah, blah, blah. And now neither of them are doing nothing, because they didn't focus on the win that comes with working together. They focus on the one drawback. And too often we do that. And this is why I don't do this with marriage. I look at the big win with marriage and not the little small things that make marriage not as fun sometimes. Like, oh, I can't go with my boys. I can't do this, can't do that as often. Like, you can still do it, but I feel like if we focus on the big one that comes with marriage or with working as a team, working with your family, we would get further, because, again, everybody else is doing it. And they're not doing it because it doesn't work. They're doing it because it does work, just a disadvantage. Just take the 90% and just eat the 10%, little small disagreements, learn how to work with those. But, I mean, even I've seen intergenerational stuff where the dad starts it, hands it off to the son or to the daughter, and they're running it. They're successful. She hands it off to her kids. Like, we got to start thinking generational and intergenerational, because the hack in that, that's my mom all the time. Like, if you and I work together, there's nothing we can't do. Mom was like, every time you post me on your page, I get more followers. I'm like, I'm supposed to make your life easier. I'm supposed to make you becoming successful easier. I'm supposed to use my platform, my leverage, my connections to then just hand you off clients. Like, it's not supposed to be a grind all the time. Everything we do is not supposed to be starting from zero, hard, hustle. Like, sometimes we just got to walk into some stuff because you have somebody who set it up for you. And it can go both ways now, because I'm a person of value. I'm not just some kid mooching off of you. Now I've built something, I can have you. And I think that's one of the things we forget as well. A lot of times parents think it's just one way, and not that it can go both ways. They don't realize, like, I'm actually helping you get further ahead. And if we just work together, you would get richer, I get richer. If we grasp that, we can make some progress.
Absolutely. And how is your 9-to-5 helped you in your business? Cause I know something you're big on. Like a lot of people are kind of, you know, get out the rat race and do whatever I'm doing on the side full time. What value do you see in doing both right now for you?
So before I was at the firm that I'm at now, I would say that the company I was with right before, it was a private family office, and that's where a lot of tech capital came from. How we structure our deals, how we do that. I would not have known that if not for working there. Right now, I work in personal injury law, so it's not necessarily the same. It's not a crossover. And so I'll say the only real value in that currently is just being in downtown LA and getting inspired by what I see all the time. But I think that you have to have a base. And so for me, I always tell people, like, my job funds my life and my business funds my lifestyle. And so, like, I use everything that I do on top of the job to fund my lifestyle, for my investments, to fund my wealth building. Whereas I don't expect my job to do that. I do not expect my job to build wealth for me. And I think expecting that is only going to lead you to be disappointed. You have an obligation to build a business. You have an obligation to build wealth on top of your job through your weekends, your evenings, through your skill set, by taking your skill set to market and using the skills you have on your job to be a consultant, to be an advisor, to make an extra. You can effectively double your salary if you just take your skills to market unashamedly. And also, one thing I tell people is, like, I don't tell people what I do anymore. Like, I'm not in the office like, oh yeah, I got a business, yeah, I'm doing this, because that kind of creates resentment. I leave them in the dark. They don't know anything. What I do in my business has nothing to do with them. They don't know it exists. They just know that I'm not out here complaining about pay. I just got extra money coming in because I do what I got to do. So I'll say that the 9-to-5 is necessary until it's not necessary. But I think you have to not just save money, you got to build passive income. So I'm looking at it, I'm like, okay, once we get the 10 doors flowing, once we get, maybe we'll flip that into some more doors. Like, I think 20 doors is the sweet spot. Once we get to 20 doors, then I could probably think about not working anymore. But I think 10 doors would just kind of allow me to do a little bit less. And we're just working up because, like I said, you got to have the consistent income. A lot of people, they'll have like $100,000 saved, $150,000 saved, and they say, I can quit my job. But that's, you can't quit your job because you haven't replaced your job. You don't replace your job with just money in the bank. You replace your job with consistent passive income, consistent revenue coming in. Then you can replace your job. And so for me, I just feel like we got to be real with ourselves. And a lot of people are trying to take the jump before they should, and they can. And a lot of people should be working when they think they shouldn't. And I'm just kind of honest with myself in that regard. Like, yeah, we do a lot. Yeah, we do well. We can do better, and we're going to do better. And one of the things that you don't want to do is leave your job before it's too soon. Because then you put stress on your business to perform. And I don't want to have a business that I'm pushing to perform, because then it's not as genuine anymore. And I feel like if people start feeling like just selling them over and over and over again, you could probably kill your business. My business and certain things thrive because I genuinely just give without needing you to give me anything back. I give value, I add value, but I'm not over here like, I got to pay the rent, I got to pay these bills, you got to buy this course, because I feel like that comes across differently. It's not as genuine. It's not as authentic, and people are going to sense that, and they might draw back from your business. And so that's why, like, I don't want to put that pressure on my business right now. I'd rather let my business just be like, even like in starting this company, like the way we structured our deals in the beginning was how we could get it started. Now we have proof of concept. Now I'm like, I'm not doing anything if it's not a JV. And then pretty soon it's like, I'm not doing anything if it's just paying 10 to 15%. I want to pay my partners 10 to 15%. But before, to get it started, I had to eat a lot. I had to forego getting paid property management fees to make sure we had the money to reinvest back into the company. And so I could only do that because I still have income coming in. And I'm not over here like, nah, like, you only get a 15% return. Peace. That, you got to do what you do. Like, that's going to hinder the growth of your organization.
Definitely. And something else I wanted to talk more about is Bless a Black Man. And so I know it's something that's very important. Yeah, very important to you. And, you know, we see all these initiatives, all these diversity initiatives, and they're great, you know, for women, for other minorities. I mean, it's great. Why isn't there a national initiative or big push to bring up Black men, in your opinion?
In my opinion, I think it's because men are competitive. And so if men do well, we tend to, I was thinking about this. I think a part of it has to do with the history. And people are so angry about what's been done to them that they have a fear that if people rise up, they're going to start trying to kind of get revenge. It's not really crazy, but sometimes I think that. I think that people, like, they are afraid that you're going to try to, like, get revenge for the slap that have been taken out against you. And I think that that's why they are in fear of that. And that's why they don't push it. I always tell people this all the time. It's going to sound crazy and kind of sexist, but the world isn't really afraid of strong women. Because at the end of the day, the strongest woman is not in the NBA. And so they'll let you have as many WNBA players as you want, but they're going to keep their NBA. And in the world, you have the NBA where men kind of run this stuff. And Caucasian men kind of run it as well. And they don't want that threatened. And so I always tell people, like, when you go to war and you're going to conquer over a city, you kill the men, you spare the women and the children. The African-American community was at war, and we did not know it, and we lost the war. How do I know we lost the war? Because all we got left is women and children. Like, we lost, man. And so I feel like that is the reason why, is because it was by design. By design, they wanted you either in jail, dead, or out of the house, broke and disgusted. And so me knowing that, you have to kind of know that there is that fear. Know that they don't want their resources or their wealth threatened. And this is why Atlanta thrives. Atlanta, a long time ago, I don't know if you know this, they had the Atlanta Compromise with Booker T. Washington and some other folks. And basically they said this. They said, hey, don't mess with us. We won't mess with you guys. Like, y'all do you over there, but let us build our stuff. Let us build our communities. Let us build wealth. Let us have our own businesses. Let's have our own schools. And, like, we're not even tripping about that political stuff. You guys have your own politics. Just let us build wealth. And I feel like in certain regards, integration kind of put us on the map to get disintegrated, because now we're a part of their community and they're like, nah, we ain't really messing with you like that. So we got to destroy you so that we can still have separation. And in California, you see that separation through wealth and class. And it's by design, where they keep you poor so that you can't fully integrate with them, and they have their wealth so that then they can still have their segregation. If you look in Orange County, California, like, an entry-level house is $2 million. And to send your kids to, like, the best school is like $1,000 a month. There's not a lot of African-American people who can do that. Therefore, they've kind of effectively created segregation. And I'm okay with that. I'm cool with that. I just need people to know, like, hey, this is what we're working with. Let's build our own stuff, because they're not messing with you. It's like I always tell people, like, the ball always moves. So you get rid of slavery, you get sharecropping, you get Jim Crow, you get redlining, you get police brutality. The ball just different, it moves. So we got to stop looking at them to solve our problems. We got to stop looking at them to be fair for us and equal to us. And we just got to, like, realize that there is greatness in us and we can do whatever we got to do. And once we, like, really grasp that, then we can really do some stuff. Then we can build our own leagues. Then we can build our own schools. Then we do all that stuff. I was thinking about this morning. I was thinking about how, like, in certain regards, desegregating the schools really just allowed them to come and teach your kids and misinform your kids and miseducate your kids. And so now you're not going to a black school with a black teacher who's teaching you empowering things. You're going to a white school that's really just white administered, but it's still black kids there. You got white teachers who are teaching you some Columbus stuff. And so I feel like in a lot of ways, there's not an initiative for African-American men because of the threat that comes with an empowered group of African-American men. But I don't want it to be that. I don't want us to become empowered just so we can go destroy other people. I want us to become empowered for the sake of being empowered. I want us to become empowered for the sake of having our own communities, safe communities, healthy schools, where we can contribute to society, not so we can go out there and ruin somebody else's stuff, or we can go take somebody else's stuff. And that's kind of the fear that integration kind of instills in people. So I told my wife this morning, I was like, because she hears me talk about this stuff all the time, but like, she's a woman. She really doesn't care. Like, as crazy as that sounds, like, women don't care. They don't. I try to get women to understand this all the time. Like, if it's so crazy, like, because women in a lot of ways are privileged. They say for, like, it's like, you ever seen that meme where it said, like, this is the housing for women when they can't afford to take care of their kids, and this is the housing for men when they can't afford to take care of their kids. And one is, like, Section 8, like, apartments, and the other is jail. And so women don't realize, like, if you are a single mom, if you don't have a man in the household, you're getting all these different sources of revenue. You're getting free food. Nobody's over here criticizing you for not going to work. You can sit in the house, just do whatever you want to do. And men are held to a different standard. And so what I realized is a lot of times people spend a lot of time trying to get white people to acknowledge their privilege, and they never do it. And women will never acknowledge their privilege either. Women will never acknowledge that they are in an advantageous situation over men because they benefit from it. Why would they want to give up their benefits? They don't. But they don't know what's good for them, because they don't know is if men do better, you do better. And so for me, I'm realizing, like, it's not their responsibility to get it. It's not their responsibility to understand it. It's not their responsibility to do the work towards changing it. The only people who are going to save African-American men are African-American men. And that's a challenge for us to just do the work and for us to make sure that we're supporting our brothers, for us to make sure, because think about it, like, it's not a lot of other people out there saving black women. Black women are saving themselves. They're doing the black girls rock. They're doing the black this and that. They're doing all these different things, and they're supporting each other. So we got to get to the point where we're supporting each other on purpose with intention, because we've acknowledged that there is an issue. And I think that the way that I realize it's an issue is, like, whenever you go to, like, whenever I'm in downtown LA, it's just nothing but African-American men just distraught, laid out on the street, asking for money. And I'm like, this is a problem, and therefore we must solve it. And it's probably the only nonprofit that I'm ever going to do, but it's still going to allow us to kind of do some really cool stuff. The goal is to build a shelter, teach people skills, teach people trades. It's so funny, like, Dr. Umar Johnson always gets on there and he says, man, they took the trades out the school. When they took the trades out the school, then black men couldn't provide. It's like, let's teach the trades then, fam.
Yeah.
Let's go and let's teach them how to be plumbers, teach them how to be electricians, teach them how to do this. Like, let's take the responsibility for changing our culture, as opposed to saying what they did, what they're not doing. Because there's more than enough time in the day, more than enough time in the week, more than enough time in the year to really change our community. And as long as you ain't out there chasing butt cheeks, you can do that.
Definitely. Can you talk more about the conference happening in Atlanta next year?
So again, the goal is to be the change and to educate and inform people. So the goal is to do this. It's the Black Men Building Wealth Conference, and there's so many dope black wealth builders. I don't think there's an intentional focus on African-American men, as we said, which I think kind of creates that expectation, is you do this conference with the Black Men Building Wealth, and it creates the expectation that you are expected to build wealth. One of my favorite quotes in this book, and I was trying to find it yesterday, it's I think it's the Jewish Phenomenon or some other book that I read about Jewish people, and they're saying that Jewish people aren't waiting on one savior, one Martin Luther King, one Malcolm X. Every single Jewish person takes it upon themselves to become that. Every single one. Every single one wakes up saying it's my job to save the race. And so I want to instill that in African-American men, and knowing that it is your responsibility. Like, yeah, I might be running my race, but don't sit here and wait for me to run my race. Run your own race alongside me and build wealth for your family and your community as well, because then we can come together as joint wealth builders and put together like a team sport. So I've reached out to Dr. Boyce Watkins. I've reached out to, of course, Jay Morrison, Andre C. Hatchett, Dr. Dennis Kimbrough, anybody who's anybody in that space. I want us to really have that conversation. And the goal is to do it at an HBCU, preferably. We'll start at an HBCU. I'm thinking Morehouse, because, I mean, men, Morehouse. So I'm thinking there. I want to make it very, very cheap for young men to come. And then, of course, I want to have the older men kind of carry the load. But the goal is to use all that money that we raise to reinvest into building a shelter for African-American men. And I know it's possible. And it'll be on purpose. And we could even go so far as like buying like an old school and redeveloping it and bringing in people for after school. Like, we have to solve our problems on purpose. And when you really start looking at the world as solving problems, opportunities and solutions present themselves to you. And so for me, like, I think this is why, like, having so many different streams is important, because then I can create a stream that's doing nothing but build up the community. And I always tell people, like, you can only have one job, but you can have as many businesses as you want. And so this is just a venture that's an idea that I'm going to put together and put in motion that's going to allow us to then build a shelter, which is going to allow us to change lives. Because it's so crazy. Like, we have all these, like, my church, for example, and I don't mean to criticize anything, but, like, we raise this money and then we build, like, orphanages in, like, Bali or, like, all these other areas. I'm like, but we got problems right here. We have problems right here. I was listening to Boyce Watkins, and he was talking about how he thinks that we should have a 10% tithe just to your community. And it's one of the things I've talked about. I've actually tweeted it. I used to go to a church called West Angeles. I'm pretty sure you know West Angeles.
Oh, yeah, and I go to West Angeles.
I was driving through there last night. I was like, they own everything. Like, they have the big cathedral. They have the theater down the street. And they have this huge, like, the old church. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that just comes from, I always tell people, like, a church is a crowdfund. It's a team sport. So if we could take that same principle and apply it to our community, we could do a lot of things. It's just a matter of taking money from Louis Vuitton, Moet, and Hennessy and putting it into our community. So that's kind of the goal. The goal is twofold: educate people and then generate income to then give back to people. Because it's like, I want to be the person that can really change stuff for African-American men, just because I spotted the problem and I'm saying, hey, like, whatever you need, scholarship, we got you. Oh, you need help with legal funding, legal counsel, we got you. Like, everything doesn't have to be a struggle. Everything doesn't have to be a hustle. Everything doesn't have to be like getting it from the ground up. If we have this dope legal fund that has a lot of attorneys that are contributing their time, like, we can solve all our problems if we just put our focus on solving the problems instead of pointing them out.
Definitely. Something else you're big on is get started to get fancy later. A lot of people, they just have to have the perfect plan. They have to do 5 years of research and they never get started. Tell me more about, you know, why you just focus on action. You don't need to have the perfect plan, you know, I's dotted, T's crossed, and all that good stuff. Why do you think it's so important to just do it?
So one of the things I tell people, if they're arguing with me and they're disagreeing with a very informed individual. And so for me, a lot of this stuff isn't my ideas. Like I told you, like, I read a lot. And the Get Started, Get Fancy Later is a Grant Cardone principle, which is also a Gary Vee principle, which is also an Eric Thomas principle. And it's also just comes from studying other people as they built their brands and their companies. I've seen, like, people will start from, like, ugly stuff, like even Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. Like, they all start somewhere. And I just want to encourage people to actually take action towards their goals, because a lot of us have great ideas, but we don't have great action. And we let maybe fear, people saying that it can't work, get in the way of that action. And you don't solve your life by anything but action. And so we need people out there taking action and putting work towards their goals, so then we can create the world that we want to see. I think that it's just something that I've seen over and over again, and it's something I kind of apply to my life. Even with the investment club, even with the investment club for real estate, even with everything we've kind of put together, like, we started and then we're like, dang, let's tweak it this way. Like, the investment club for stocks, it wasn't what it is now. It's a lot more polished now. It's a lot more streamlined now. It's less responsibility on me. But we could never have gotten to that level if we hadn't taken action. We came to the people that are creators of that investment club act, like, kind of application. And we're like, we already got an investment club that has 300 members. We have this much in assets. We're looking to roll it over. And so at that point, I'm having a conversation with the CEO. You don't have that conversation if you're just starting. And I think that that's why you got to start, because at this point I'm having a conversation. Like, imagine if I hadn't bought anything yet in regards to real estate. And I'm over here like, yeah, I'm just trying to, like, get started in real estate. Like, no, like, now I come to the table, like, we own this. We're trying to do this. Now my mentor and I talk as peers. Now my contractor and I talk as peers. Now other investors and I talk as peers. And you don't get there without taking action. That's so funny. I just got a text message from, it's a nice looking house too, from my landscaper, and he has a house for sale. It's a good looking house too. I think I want it. But
there you go.
You don't get that without action. Like, as I take action, as I make contacts, as people realize that I'm a player, opportunities come to me. And you can't get opportunities sitting there thinking and hoping and plotting. You've got to get in the field. You got to get your uniform dirty. You got to get out there and have your head on the swivel. And I think that that is what I want. I want to encourage more people to play the game and not on the sidelines. And I think that once we get to that space, there's nothing that we can't do. And a lot of people do it because they don't want to make mistakes, or they don't want to do it wrong. And I think that making mistakes and doing it wrong is just a part of the process. If you aren't making mistakes, you're not trying anything new. And if you're not trying anything new, you're only going to have what you've always had. And so it's like people are unhappy with what they have, but they also don't want to make mistakes towards getting what they want. And what I want to encourage people to tell you is, like, mistakes are just part of the process. There's no such thing as a perfect deal. There's no such thing as a perfect anything. You just got to get out there and just make mistakes and launch and then iterate and launch and then iterate and then revise what you have and sharpen that stone until it becomes a diamond. And it's just something I've seen work. It's something that I've applied to my life, and it works.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So just an off-topic question. I'm sure you heard about the new law in California that's going to impact Uber and Lyft and kind of their drivers. I think there's like minimum wage and things of that nature. I think the minimum wage and they're attempting to unionize, just a bunch of stuff. And long story short, it's going to cost each company and these kind of gig companies, it's going to cost them a lot of money. And the first thing people think about is, oh, you know, what's going to happen with the stock price? And, you know, should I sell my share? Should I buy? Can you talk more about how much you factor in what's happening in the news? And when you think about like buying companies or selling off your shares, do you care about what's happening in the news? Do you just kind of go with what you believe and make investments based on that?
I would say that it depends. Mm-hmm. It really does depend. You have to look at the strength of the company, the size of the company. You have to look at how long they've been that company. And so, for example, like with, I always tell people, like, buy bad news. But that's kind of like buy bad news with an asterisk, because you never know. We buy great companies that have bad news. Uber is so young and they're still kind of getting started that we don't have any idea what that could kind of affect. However, one of the benefits of investing in the stock market is that you have very, very educated and informed and well-resourced individuals working on your behalf. And so Uber is backed by billionaires and it's staffed with Stanford folk and all these very, very educated and informed individuals. And so I think that that's kind of the bet that you're making. A lot of people, they allow the news to kind of talk them out of stuff. And I would say that in that regard, I don't really listen to the news, especially if it's a company that I love. And I use Uber all the time. Every day I get lunch from Uber. I'm always using Uber. And that's why I like Uber. I was thinking about this today or this morning because WeWork is potentially going into bankruptcy. Yeah. But I'm not sure if they already IPO, but they're going to IPO. And I've had people who kind of criticized Uber and they're saying it doesn't make any money. They don't make any money yet. I don't buy companies that don't make money. And I tell people, like, Amazon didn't make money for like 14 years.
Wow.
Like, Apple struggled for a long time. Netflix was struggling for a long time, just spending money and taking on debt to create content. And when you're an investor, you have to be a visionary. And that's true, not just in real estate or in business, but also in stocks. And so you have to see what that company can become. You have to see what other people don't see, despite the noise, despite these educated people who are giving these opinions about why it's not a good company and why it's not doing that. Like, the ego, my ego does not allow anybody to tell me what I think is a good opportunity or not opportunity. I don't care how educated and informed they are, how successful they are. I'm not listening because I feel like I'm going to do my own due diligence. I've read the books. I'm watching the TV shows. I'm listening to the podcast. I'm going to be informed enough on my own. So I would just tell people, like, when I look at news, I'm always buying the bad news and a lot of times selling the good news. And I learned that because I used to do the opposite. I would buy the good news and then you lose money because sometimes it runs up too high. and it'll run up too high on the hype and the mania, and then you're left holding the bag when it normalizes. But a lot of times on the bad news, it'll dip too hard. And if it dips too hard, you get in at the low or the low-ish, and then you can kind of ride it up when it corrects. Even if it doesn't go all the way back to where it was, if it goes up to like halfway or three-fourths of the way, you're still making money. So when I hear bad news, I'm buying, especially if I see that stock tanking. Like, don't sell. One of the worst things you could do is sell bad news, because then you're just like, you're kind of playing into their hands. A lot of times, like, people will put out bad news just to create a bad opportunity or to create a buying opportunity. In regards to that, I blame California. California's the devil. But one thing I think is that they're going to adapt. Like the book said, rich people don't just lay down. They adapt. And I think that Uber is going to adapt. They're going to find a way to make whatever that law is work in their favor. They have a lot of lawyers working for them. They have a lot of MBAs working for them, a lot of very wealthy people that are working for them, a lot of well-connected people working for them, and they're going to find a way around it. I'm super bullish on Uber. I'm also just bullish on a lot of these IPOs. And I feel like a lot of times people are trying to I tell people sometimes, like, I invest in IPOs kind of like a VC, where I buy it all, and if one or two pop, then cool. Like, we bought Beyond Meat, it popped. Cool. We also bought, I think, Slack, and it might have dropped. But we're not investing for ownership. I tell people a lot of times, like, in a lot of ways, your grandparents didn't fail to leave you wealth because they bought the wrong stock. They didn't buy any stocks. They didn't fail because they bought a property in the wrong market. They didn't leave you any property. Any property is an inheritance, but we're just made to believe that there's this right way, there's this perfect way to do it. Like, no, you just got to do it. And as you're out there taking activity, you're going to get to the wealth that you desire.
Definitely. So just a couple more questions here before we wrap up. What are some books that you recommend? That I know you're a really big book guy. Or any maybe 2-3 books that changed the game for you that you recommend people read? Just kind of starting out in real estate and business.
Let's see. So this book right here, Cashflow Quadrant, is a really good one. It'll change your life. It accompanies Rich Dad Poor Dad. You have to read Rich Dad Poor Dad. A lot of people don't really focus on this book too much, but he talks about like the E, the B, the S, and the I, and different quadrants that you can be in. I think that's a really important book. One of my favorite books is by Simon Sinek, and I just saw somebody post it. And is it Simon Sinek? No, it's not. It's I forget his name. I think it's Holiday. And it's The Obstacle is the Way. And that is a really, really good book. It kind of just talks about how, like, a lot of the things that we think are hindrances are actually, like, opportunities. And we should be running towards the obstacle as opposed to away from the obstacle. Man.
Is that your shelf?
There's so many. Yeah, I have a shelves in here.
Yeah, I just finished Cashflow Quadrant maybe 2 weeks ago. It's really good.
It is a good book.
Yeah, Rich.
How to Win Friends is good too. What was it? Why should white guys have all the fun by Reginald Lewis is a great book. I don't think it's by him, but it's about him. Man, Outliers is a great book. I think Outliers is a good book just because it tells you that a lot of the successful people aren't just born that way. They've just put in their 10,000 hours. And if you want to be on that level, you just got to put in your time and the effort. And I think that kind of distills a lot of myths, because we think that, like, well, LeBron's just ultra talented, or Kobe's just ultra talented, or Steve Jobs or Bill Gates are just ultra talented. No, they just put in their hours. And so it kind of, like, it instills in you that work and putting in that time and the effort. Man. Of course, Rich Dad Poor Dad, a great book, Start With Why. I think this book is a lot of the reason why I tell people that I'm not focused on the money as much as I'm focused on the why. This book talks about, like, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And so I think that's why, like, even in building my business, I'm not so focused on the money. And doing real estate, I'm not focused on the money. On solving problems for people, I'm not focused on the money. I'm focused on the calling, I'm focused on the cause, because that comes through and people get attracted to it. If I was just out here like, yeah, give us donations so we can do this, like, nobody would come. But if I can create a conference that's going to serve multiple purposes, it's going to educate people and raise funds, like, that is a why, and it's going to allow us to actually grow it. And so I think that this book actually is what really pushes me towards doing things for the purpose and not for the paper.
Definitely.
Cool. The Secret is a good book. the Bible is a good book. The Bible has the gems, especially in regards to marriage. One thing I like about the Bible is, and I tell people this all the time, is like, there are certain things in the Bible that people think that like God is keeping you from, but he's actually like propelling you towards certain things. So if you just adhere to the lessons in the Bible, your life will be blessed. And so people are always like wanting to do whatever they want to do, and they pray for what they want, and they hope that they're blessed when God already told us what we got to do. And so like, even in marriage, it's like God said, love your wife. And he didn't say love your wife with love your wife if she does this, love your wife if she does that. Like, no, he said, love your wife like Christ loves the church. And I always tell people, like, the church, sometimes we be wilding out. We do what we want to do. We don't listen. We don't follow the commandments. But Christ still loves us. And so that's the approach that I take in marriage. Like, I love her despite what she does. And for that, I'm blessed. There's so many principles in the Bible. I mean, abstaining from, like, drunkenness or sexual immortality or immorality and all these different things, like, in the Bible, it just allows your life to be blessed. And the crazy part about the Bible is, like, almost every principle that you see in any self-help book has come from the Bible. And so, yeah, like, especially in marriage, like, I lean on that book a lot. I'm always reading it. I'm always learning from it. Like, it's just so much wisdom in that book. And you can put so much trust in that book, whereas other books, maybe not so much. You don't really know what their motive is. So, man, there's so many. Jewish Phenomenon is a great book. Millionaire Fastlane is a great book. There's a lot.
Cool. Yeah, I think we got a good list. That's good, man. And what is one goal that you are working towards accomplishing by the end of this year?
Man. I would like to have all 10 of our doors done. Nice. And preparing to buy another 10 more.
Definitely. Awesome. And where can people reach you? Where can people find your products? I definitely include all this in the show notes. Something else I've heard you say is that, you know, people want help, people want this, people want that, but they don't want to support, they don't want to buy anything. I believe it's very important to invest in people and to buy their products and learn from the intellectual property they're putting out. So where can people reach you? Where can people contact you? And where can people buy your products and invest with you? All that good stuff.
Right. So when we run through the list, I would say the first place to start is gumroad.com/Ty Capital. We have the long distance real estate course there. We have the LLC formation services there. We have the course on how to form your own LLC there. We have the book. We have t-shirts. We have everything. We're constantly trying to build out that product line to help more people. We have the Ty Capital website, which is www.capitalty.com, where you can find the blog, you can find the podcast, you can find the blog and the podcast, as well as like some information pages for the different products and the different like clubs we have. Of course, the social media, Twitter @ToddBilly. I lost my other Twitter. So I have a new one. It's @ToddBilly. Instagram is @ToddMillionaire. The business Instagram is @ToddInvestments. The Blessed Black Man on Instagram @BlessedBlackMan. Also check out @BlackwellTweetTalk, which is another podcast that we have going on. And I think that might be it. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I appreciate it. I definitely appreciate you coming on, man. It's a wealth of knowledge here. It's definitely inspiring to see another brother doing some good things and trying to raise people up and not, you know, complaining and begging the government for stuff. So it's refreshing to see that, man. So I appreciate you. Definitely appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me, man.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into episode 2 of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. You can follow us on Instagram @BlackRealEstateDialogue. Hope you all enjoyed. Look forward to next week's episode.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.